This is At the Edge of Canada, Indigenous Research, a show about Indigenous researchers doing research with Indigenous communities in Canada and beyond. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Falconulet, and I hope you will enjoy this show. Tense.
Hey, hey, la belle rivière, coudre avec pour moi, j'aime mieux que vite voir avec un old boxa. Hey, hey, la belle fille, ça m'a dit danser, pretty belle fun avec ma Indian squaw. Brim, did it, 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 did it. Hey, Jean-Pierre, j'ai devu passer dans un walk, qui te mousse à ton lèle. Come on, you little bugger, can you hear you one with a gun in your back and your horse on the run. Pretty belle down, did it, did it, did it, did it, did it, did it. Come on, you little bugger, can you hear you? Better jump on your horse, better get long gone. Midi, mademoiselles, in the midi, mindy, watch the voyage like an old mother hen. Hey, hey, Jean-Pierre, it's gonna lair, bien free. I wish a little gal would marry me. Tomorrow morning, I'll go see Saint-Père. I tell him that I love his little filly dear. I'll go with him to see Monsieur Le Curé. I'll tell him, ring-a-ling, I'm gonna change my way. Bang, diddle, nip down, diddle, diddle, dip down, la la diddle, la la diddle, la diddle, 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 diddle. This is the story of a one lone man, up against a white in the Indian clan, trying to make a living on the lone prairie with a pretty squad that I marry. Bang, diddle, nip down, diddle, diddle, dip down, la la diddle, la diddle, la diddle.
So welcome to At the Edge of Canada. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Falconulet, and today I have a very special guest, Michael Mascarenhas, who has written a book called Where the Waters Divide. It's about neoliberalism, white privilege, and environmental racism in Canada. Michael, why did you write a book about this? Why is it important to know about these issues?
You know, for the most part, I kind of stumbled upon this work. I was doing my PhD at Michigan State in 1999, and all of a sudden we had these really serious sort of water problems. You know, the Washington occurred, and then North Battleford, Saskatchewan occurred, and I started to ask some questions as to what was sort of causing some of these environmental problems. Was there some sort of theoretical frameworks which I could help me understand this? And you know, a lot of folks were writing on neoliberalism at the time, and I started to look at how neoliberalism was affecting environmental conditions. And what became quite obvious to me at the time was that neoliberalism was having quite a disproportionate impact on First Nations communities. But this wasn't being picked up in the media necessarily. You know, people were talking about, say, the water outbreak in Vancouver and privatization of water in the big cities, but the concerns on First Nations reserves was not being addressed at all not so much in the media, but not very much in scholarship as well. And so this kind of, I think, motivated me to kind of try to make a connection between changes in the larger political economy, what people have come to label neoliberalism, and its impact on First Nations communities, because I thought it was impacting them disproportionately.
Now, I'm sure a lot of people who are listening were thinking to themselves, well, what really is neoliberalism? And if you really wish to understand it, I think you should really read this book. It's actually quite an incredible read. It's in a rather nondescript cover, but when you actually start getting into it, it's a very interesting. And so what is neoliberalism? Because a lot of people don't really understand that term.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's a good question. you know, it's a form of governance that has taken hold over the last 30 years. And so it's taken different shapes and different forms in different countries. It was introduced in, say, Chile under Pinochet's regime. It was introduced under Margaret Thatcher in the UK, Ronald Reagan in the US. And it's since taken hold ever since. It has become a paradigm of governance, if you will. And in Canada, it's taken shape in different places, but under Mike Harris in Ontario, more sort of poignantly in the 1990s. And, you know, neoliberalism has a couple particular kind of principles, if you will, or characteristics. One is, you know, let the market decide. You know, so whether that's, you know, drinking water or healthcare or Social Security, the best way to manage that social service is to let the market decide that. And that's kind of a new way of thinking about how we want to live our lives, right, and conduct our social programs. Another one is that good government is pro-business, right? That's another kind of new way of thinking about governance. That, you know, historically, governments were able to leverage bonds and securities in order to build things like infrastructure. And then in a downturn in an economy, you know, the state might be able to employ people in hard times. You know, what does a business sector do in hard times? They typically lay off the workforce. So in many ways, government has been able to not necessarily be pro-business, but that has been a very useful way of managing through, say, fiscal crises.
Well, in the 50s, the government was often seen as a counterbalance to business with Keynesian politics and policy in England and in Europe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so that's been an important shift. And I think what ends up happening then is that government no longer becomes concerned with politics. It no longer becomes concerned with issues of social justice and equity. And government becomes increasingly more concerned with administration. And plays much more supervisory role in setting up markets, let's say, in providing the means with which to, let's say, privatize water systems or road systems or other social systems. And so politics becomes kind of eclipsed out of governance. And an example is sort of the recent budgetary bill that's just been passed regarding First Nations. And it comes under, I think it's a fiscal transparency bill. And what that does essentially is it takes a very political issue, and that is sort of the First Nations equity and First Nations welfare, and puts it into a budgetary bill, right? Puts it into a budgetary discourse. And then government gets to kind of circumvent this very mainstream social problem that it has. And that is its inability to accept its contractual agreements for First Nations.
See, you're talking about the new bill, the omnibus bill, the bill C-45 was just passed in Canada, and that there's quite a great controversy about it with the I Don't Know More movement and the First Nations, and then the hunger strike of Chief Theresa Spence.
Right. Yes. Exactly.
But I was listening to, for instance, the Frontier Center, which is a group. Which is rather on the right of the political spectrum. And they were saying, well, these measures that we're putting in place in this bill are going to help First Nations in the long term, because instead of having to wait years and years to obtain approval and having to go through all consultations and discuss with people, we can get approval and we can lease reserve land or sell it even to non-Aboriginal, non-First Nation interests, and the land can be developed in the interests of economic development.
Right. But
one thing I really loved about your book was this tying in of neoliberalism and the idea of racism. Because when you speak to a lot of Canadians, even right now with this Idle No More movement, what's going on in Canada, and you hear people say, well, you know, I'm not racist. Society was racist 100 years ago, Canada. It's somewhat, not like the Americans often Canadians will say. But when you start digging deeper, and you lay it out really, really succinctly in this book about this idea that racism, this idea of white privilege, still exists today, but it's just under another form, and we've just covered it over with this idea of neoliberalism. I was wondering if you could just tell me a bit about that.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, the point you brought up before about, you know, sort of this, the issue of the Ombudsman Bill and how it's going to make things more efficient. I think, you know, that in itself is fundamentally neoliberalism. I mean, the only metrics which count in terms of social welfare, is economics. And you know, there are a whole bunch of other ways you might be able to think about how human welfare can benefit not only First Nations but all sorts of social groups. But to simply, you know, say that economic justification narrows the way people might think about social policy, right? But to talk to you, to answer your sort of question about neoliberalism as sort of racism by other means, let's say, you know, most people don't often conflate, I think, racism with kind of hostile acts, you know, something that they see in public or some sort of intentional act. And what I wanted to try and show was how neoliberalism is a form of uneven development. And that uneven development disproportionately impacts people who don't have power in political systems. And so the other part, I think, to think about in terms of neoliberalism as a racial formation is that it does privilege certain groups of people at the expense of others. So a couple of examples would be in Ontario with Mike Harris's kind of common sense revolution. There were many amendments that allowed for the sightings of sewage treatment plants, allowed for the privatization of landfills. And what you found as a result was that Toronto got to move its garbage to the Green Lane landfill, ended up buying that Green Lane landfill. The Green Lane landfill is located 3 kilometers from 3 First Nations communities. You found that that the city of London, Ontario, was able to change its official community plan, turn lands that were previously in the agricultural land reserve and move them, zone them as industrial, and site their new sewage treatment plant 3 kilometers from First Nations communities. Now, what happens as a result of that is, say, in the case of London, London is able to build a very nice development in the southwest corner of its city, elite for elite communities, for middle class Canadians. But it gets to do that because it can offset the deleterious aspects of its production. In this case, sewage treatment plants. At the sewage treatment plant gets put in First Nations community. And that's how you know, if you want to think about a racial formation and this idea of racism and white privilege together, I think it's an important example. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, it's because what you write in the book as well is what distinguishes today, I'm quoting you, on what distinguishes today's racism from previous racial formations of the Canadian state is that neoliberalism is largely seen as a technical and administrative project, not as a racial one. And I think for me that, you know, that really summed it up. That idea that today the society, if Aboriginal people want to get ahead, if they want to become successful in society, they just have to integrate, which is essentially for me another synonym for assimilate, into the mainstream society and do the exact same things that everyone else is doing, and they'll be successful. But yet what you're pointing out in your book is that even if people attempt to do that, and I have students here at the University of Manitoba which attempt to do that, they're not successful sometimes because they have a lot of other baggage from previous generations which are impeding them in succeeding. And so I think I think it's really indicative when you talk about that. And I think, like, for instance, the question of North Battleford and the water quality, because, you know, North Battleford or even Walkerton, it's a fine demonstration. North Battleford's has a very large Aboriginal population. I don't know if you know this. It's actually it's just actually just beside my reserve where I'm from. And so when they had that water crisis there, you know, there were people on either side of because they have another town just beside it that has its water source elsewhere. And so there was actually this dynamic going on of, you know, well, you know, we'll get our water from this side and that side, well, they'll figure it out eventually. And so there was this kind of interesting racial dynamic going on in North Battleford at that time.
Yeah, no, and it's quite fascinating, really. I mean, it doesn't really get played out in the mainstream media, that, you know, around racial inequities that are surrounding these environmental injustices. And, you know, I think one of the things that neoliberalism brings about is this kind of discourse about individuality and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, you know. And so under neoliberalism, under the discourse of neoliberalism, First Nations, and it's quite a lot of minority populations, fail because they don't try hard enough, or they don't adopt a particular discourse. In this case, as you've suggested, this kind of economizing of practices, and it, quite often you simply blame, the victim in this case gets blamed, and neoliberalism is so subtle in doing that, because we all believe that we work hard, and that we all pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, and therefore those who don't succeed obviously are simply lazy. And what that kind of eclipses in many ways is the sort of racial formation of the way inequalities are kind of rooted in political decisions, rooted in regulation, rooted in history. And it's unfortunate that kind of ideology continues to pervade political discussions and even just the way people themselves think about First Nations communities and another minority.
Now, what you were talking earlier, you talked about this idea of common sense. And right. In the book, you mentioned that neoliberalism, as it's known, is also known as another synonym for that is common sense, the common
right.
sense revolution of Mike Harris. And it becomes, you said it's become so pervasive
right.
in society. Like, so how do you go about, because if you want to present a different viewpoint, and you want to talk about a different way of seeing the world, which a lot of indigenous peoples believe in,
right.
a different way of doing things, a different way of seeing the world, which not to say that it's right or wrong, but simply that it's another way of doing something, that they're often marginalized because they say, well, that's not common sense.
Yeah, it becomes, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's so clever. Right? I mean, and it's such a overwhelming kind of presenting a particular political ideology. I mean, I remember how many times my father would say, it's just common sense, and you make you feel so bad. Oh yeah, of course, right. But it's like it's such a convincing rhetoric that people to question common sense is to be nonsensical, Oh, it's just the way it is, and that, again, it just eclipses any institutional mechanisms, all of history, in a very, in two words, common sense. And it's amazing in that sense how powerful that platform has been. And it continues to be used, in the Harper government as well, and in others, of course. I mean, quite often we'll hear Barack Obama saying, well, this is just common sense. This is a common sense thing to do. And it gets used as this is something we shouldn't question because it just doesn't, it's not something that needs to be questioned.
So how does this common sense then go about preserving this idea of white privilege, this idea that because of the history of Canada, of the United States, that white people of, I don't want to use the word race, but their position in society they're able to maintain it for themselves, their children, their grandchildren into the future.
I'm sorry, I missed your question. Could you say it again?
Yeah, so how does the idea of common sense play out in preserving this idea of white privilege?
Yeah, well, I mean, quite strongly, I think, if you just think about the fiscal cliff and one of the big debates around the fiscal cliff in the United States was the estate tax, and this idea that people should be able to it's just common sense that people should be able to keep the money that they earned and give it to their family, and not let the government happen. And of course, in the United States, this is particularly the rhetoric against government is quite strong here. But you get a sense that people have earned that, and that regardless of who they are, and that shouldn't be shared or redistributed. That's theirs. And again, that kind of what that does is it kind of eclipses the fact that that we're been given doors. Doors have opened to them, and they have been given things like land and jobs and positions in political power at the same time as doors have closed for other folks, other groups. That is history, in a sense. But something like common sense kind of eclipses that history in a way that's not healthy. And, you know, power works because it's invisible, I think. That's the other part that I wanted to bring out in the book. I mean, when we think about race, you know, and I ask students, you know, to tell me what words come to mind when I say the word race, many students will say, you know, African-American, they may say Hispanic, Latino, Asian, First Nations. And when I ask them to say, well, what, you know, give me a word that comes to mind when I say gender, you know, a lot of students will say, well, feminine, girl, woman. And if you ask students again, I'll stop there. But, you know, but as if white is not a race and male is not a gender, right? And so we don't see white as a race and we don't see male as a gender necessarily because they work because they're the dominant paradigm. And dominance works largely because it's invisible. And so I think the role that I have and others is to kind of make those dominant structures that are largely invisible, try to make them visible and try to get people to see how historically certain groups have political advantages, and that has to be understood when we think about social justice.
And you talk a lot about the term, the idea of social reproduction.
Right.
That, you know, society is always attempting to, various groups, various peoples are always attempting to reproduce socially what's happening. So the idea that a society is reproducing itself.
Right.
So how is that? Because a lot of people aren't familiar with that term. I was wondering if you could just talk about a bit about that.
Sure. Well, you know, social reproduction as a sort of theory comes, you can stretch that all the way back to sort of Marx and Engels who write about the family and family reproduction. And much of sort of analysis around political economy is often spent on economic reproduction. So, we talk about GNP and GDP, much of our analysis is focused on economic metrics. But there's also society is also based on systems of social reproduction, and that is sort of services or activities that don't easily aren't easily evaluated based on economics. And so you might think of the family as a way of reproducing itself in all sorts of sort of subtle ways through education, through nourishment, through self, you know, through safe houses or good shelters and clean environments, access to drinking water, good education. Those sorts of things that are not necessarily economic in its evaluation, but builds a social system that reproduces people, reproduces communities, that allows them to be, let's say, productive citizens in society. And by focusing on economic activities only, which neoliberalism tends to do, everything that's measured is fundamentally an economic metric, we sort of eclipse this sort of other aspect of building societies, which scholars have called social reproduction.
For you, when you're looking at the contemporary events that are going on right now in the Idle No More movement here in Canada, this idea of protest and this idea that racism doesn't exist, and I look at this and I go on, for instance, the Globe and Mail, and I read the online comments, and what I was really surprised about was the number of comments that had to be removed because they didn't meet the requirements for proper discourse on their website. And the ones that they had there were still laid in with some were quite a bit of bigotry. And I'm thinking to myself, even the term "I don't know more," is it just forcing people into this idea of confrontation? Is it just forcing people into the black and white? You're either for good governance, good neoliberalism, you're for common sense, or you're for the Aboriginal people. And then the Aboriginal people are saying, well, you're either for us or you're against human rights. Can't we be a bit nuanced here in this discussion? What are your thoughts on the I Don't Know More movement?
Well, I think I support the movement. I think it's justified. I think it's overdue in many ways. I have been part of particular movements. I'm petitioning particular governments. I've worked with Indian Northern Affairs on particular issues. But I think the recent budgetary decisions by the federal government, particularly around the redesignation of waterways and other things, have really culminated in just saying enough is enough, I think. You know, every government has started on a campaign of what they might call the Indian problem. We're going to fix the Indian problem, you know. And under Martin, they had the Kelowna Accord. That was quickly swept away when Harper came into government. And Stephen Harper's never, as far as I'm concerned, never really had much, I think, time or inclination to consult First Nations. I think that's a problem for a leader, the leader of Canada.
Why would he consult with First Nations? Because it wouldn't fit in with he knows what his ideology is.
Right. But he's the Prime Minister of all Canadians, and that includes First Nations. And so I am surprised at the sort of apathy, the particular indifference, and the continued racism of many many Canadians regarding First Nations. And I'm kind of struck by that, actually. I'm kind of deeply kind of disturbed by the fact that so many Canadians would react as you've described. I mean, in the United States, racism is a continual conversation, and part of that, I think, is part the history of slavery in the United States, and just the history of bigotry, and that continues today. But in Canada, there's for some reason racism has not been given its due course, and it might be because Canadians think of themselves as multicultural, and multiculturalism is in the Constitution, and it's hard to kind of hard to frame a nation as having a racial formation when everyone thinks of it as a multicultural nation. And so, there is that I think a lot of Canadians see themselves as being truly multicultural, see themselves as not being part of First Nations continued oppression, and therefore feel that they have no role to play. And that's unfortunate. It really is.
And with that, Michael, thank you very much. Igo se.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Michael Mascarenhas, who's an associate professor in the Science and Technology Studies Department at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in the United States, Troy, New York. He has written a book called Where the Waters Divide, about neoliberalism, white privilege, and environmental racism in Canada. We discuss contemporary issues such as the I Don't Know More movement, hunger strikes, and the ideas of white privilege and neoliberalism. You have been listening to At the Edge of Canada, Indigenous Research, a show which interviews researchers and people of prime importance to Indigenous issues. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Falconillet, a program director with the Aboriginal Focus Programs at the University of Manitoba. If you wish to hear past episodes or find out more information, you may find it on our website at theedgeofcanada.com. At theedgeofcanada.com.
Do you have what it takes? Thanks to the Access and Aboriginal Focus Programs at the University of Manitoba, you could be a university grad before you know it. The Access and Aboriginal Focus Programs are now accepting applications. Priority is given to Aboriginal, Northerners, and minority groups. As an Access student, you will receive extra supports such as free tutors, academic counseling, course instruction, personal counseling, and the possibility of some financial assistance. To find out more, call 474-8000. That's 474-8000. The Access application deadline is April 1st. So, be a warrior, make your family proud.